Hello and welcome to another episode of City on a Hill, a podcast about what it means to be a citizen of heaven and a citizen of the United States. We want to encourage Christians to find their tribe in the church and their hope in the kingdom of God, rather than to seek both in the kingdom of man. So with that, let's get to it today.
Well, hello, my name is Eric Estep.
And I'm Scott Reevely.
And this is the City on a Hill podcast. Welcome back to another episode. And it might sound a little different today. I'm actually sitting in my basement. I am in quarantine. I caught the coronavirus and now I'm in quarantine. I'm trying to isolate from my family and see if they can stay healthy and I don't have to give it to them, which means there might be some sound that's a little bit different than normal. So we are on Zoom. We haven't been on Zoom in a long time. So there's that difference. And then there's plenty of background noise. So if you hear some fun kids in the background, that's what's going on. We're here, we're ready to go. And today we wanted to pull from our mailbag and
mailbag, nice.
Pull from our mailbag, one of the questions we got, and just use that and volley around with that today. I think it's going to be helpful and make for a fun discussion. So this is it's kind of a long one, so I'll just read it and we can pull it apart as we go, or not as we go, but after we're done. So the email says, my husband and I have been talking about the American Revolutionary War. Of course, being raised in the States, we have been taught that the early fight for independence was the most noble and valiant of causes. However, where does Christianity interact with this? Honor the king and render to Caesar what is Caesar's does not seem at face value to coexist well with the colonial protest of no taxation without representation. However, it makes sense that the rule of a governing authority at some point can get too unjust or wicked to submit to. We can all think of those cases where the offenses against image bearers by the rulers would be grievous enough to no longer submit to and in fact should be fought. However, was this by any means the case in colonial America under British rule? Caesar himself or Nero or Domitian, whoever was in power when 1 Peter was written, were not exactly shining examples of virtue. Curious where the Puritans stood on this, but I could do that digging myself unless you already know. And then finally, obviously, this conversation is incredibly relevant to the historical moment in both our individual and corporate responses as Christians to governing authorities in the face of varying levels of injustice. Also, I'm about to homeschool my kids and really don't want to screw the pooch if we get our perspectives on our own history all wrong. So that is, I just love that. That's a great question.
Normally you'd say this is a great question, but in fact, this is probably three or four great questions.
Mm-hmm.
I'll just take the last one. You know, can I screw up my kids when I homeschool them? The answer is yes. And you will. It's just a matter of how badly. So trust that this will help, at least on the American Revolution side of things.
And you're someone who homeschooled your kids, so
yeah,
you're not saying don't do that. I think one thing I like about this question so much is the desire to, I need to figure this out and learn this well so that I can teach my kids well.
Well, and that's actually what homeschooling does for most parents, is they learn way more when they're teaching than they did when they were actually kids. So good for you, and hopefully we can help here.
So how would you pull it apart? What's the next one?
I would pull it apart and just start with, how does Christianity intersect with the American Revolution, and does taxation without representation constitute a just war? And it is an interesting question, because one of the history books that I read posed it this way: why were Americans willing to fight and die to separate themselves from what in retrospect looks like a rather mild British rule? And I think that's, when you frame it that way, it's really an interesting question. Because you've got a relationship with Britain that they don't like, and they're liking less and less, but it is, they were willing to risk their lives, the lives of their family, and that to to break with British rule. So, anyway, yeah, that's the difficulty of the question. And I think when you say, how does Christianity intersect with that? It's pretty hard to say that taxation without representation is a scriptural or a Christian issue. You know, that said, there's a history that, and this is one of the things I've been learning, is there's a history that the people in the colonies had that I don't have, or at least it's far more distant for me. And that is, I mean, they know, or their grandparents knew, of religious persecution in England. That's why so many of them came over. And so they were known as dissenters. And so they were used to dissent. In fact, that was one of the, I mean, that was one of the reasons that they came to the New World, was because of their dissent against the ideas and the rule in Britain. And so they had, or they thought they had, I think, religious reason, because that's what religion had meant for them for so many years, was this dissent against the religion that was in power. And so here they're now in a new context, and dissent, you might say, is second nature.
And would you say that's beyond, so Protestant protest, that's in addition to just the general Protestant posture they would have from Reformation, pulling away from the Roman Catholic Church?
Yeah, I think it's a specific, there are some specific varieties of dissenters that had extra concern, particularly with England. If they were Congregationalists or Presbyterians, for instance, they would have been dissenters and not Anglican. So they were used to this dissent, and that really is part of their heritage. So I think that's one piece that's important. I think another piece that's important as far as how Christianity intersects is the, I think Christianity formed I don't know what you would say, but a basis for the value of the individual. And so because we're made in the image of God, there was this insistence on freedom of conscience. And I think that freedom of conscience was part of what led so many of the colonists to, again, dissent against Britain when it came to lots of things, not just religion. Mm-hmm. And that I think you can, in at least in part, pin on Christianity. In other words, there are some Christian reasons, I think, namely image of God, primarily image of God, to say the individual matters and the individual should be free to follow their conscience. So there's some Christian underpinnings there. My personal opinion is that's pretty weak underpinning to risk life and your family for. But nonetheless, I think if you were looking for how does Christianity impact it, you'd have to go there probably also. Mm-hmm. I think you probably can go as well to natural law. I'm going to go to natural law because I do think that the Puritans in particular, and the again, that was the heritage that most New Englanders had. Somebody said 3/4 of them had a Calvinist Puritan history, or religious history, basically. They may not have been practicing, may have been their parents, it may have been their ancestors, but that was the vein of Protestantism that they were in. And their view, I believe, was that the law of God and natural law were compatible. Let me say it that way. And that compatibility.
Can you describe for our listeners natural law? What you're referring to when you talk about natural law?
Okay, so natural law is what, for instance, Jefferson referred to in when he said life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness were rights that were self-evident. The self-evident nature of those would come from John Locke, who was a proponent of natural law, and he tried to do for, I guess, for the world what in politics, what Isaac Newton did for physics, and kind of make general universal moral laws based on reason alone. And that was some of the, again, some of what the founders and the revolutionaries were imbibing in were the ideas of John Locke, which gave them this natural law. And they, I think, saw that was, well, in the words of George Marsden, he said, both Puritan emphasis on covenant and later Enlightenment formulations reinforced and helped consolidate one of the most valuable principles that long had been developing in the British heritage, and that foundational principle for American Republic, that nations must be governed by the rule of law, that this was going to be a, you know, natural outcome. So that's what Locke thought, and the Puritans kind of held the same idea with religious fervor, and those two things laid over each other gave them what they felt was a religious reason for this revolution.
And I think one of the things that's super interesting with the American Revolution piece and this coming together of rationalism, Enlightenment, the Puritans, all those things, this is the birth or result of the birth of liberalism. You've already mentioned the individual having value, but liberalism takes it further and says the individual is sovereign, and that allows for a completely different way of looking at the world that I would argue is not... It's an ism. There's an ideology to it that's not necessarily a biblical ideology, and it's throughout the Declaration of Independence. Those inalienable rights are for individuals. All men are created equal, and thus they have the ability to consent to government or not. And then if we don't like the way things are going, it talks about disbanding the government, the connections, the political connections that we have, and that's not a conversation that would have even made sense to people 300 years before that. Like, what do you mean? What do you mean we're going to disband the political bands? That doesn't make any sense. You're in this community, or you're in this tribe, or you belong to this people. And tyrants definitely got overthrown, even in Greek or Roman history, that kind of thing. But this is a different way of thinking about it. And we have different heritage. We're swimming in different soup. We're in different water. And I think that's worth talking about.
And so I think that's the best I can do to say there's Christian support for a revolution. Shall I say it that way? There is a sermon that you cited, Eric, that talked about whether it was right and just, and it said that it asked about whether the rebellion was proper, and the answer to which is plain, that it was not, but a most righteous, glorious stand made in defense of the natural and legal rights of people against the unnatural and illegal encroachments of an arbitrary power. And that was part of a Christian sermon that was citing this natural law that we've been talking about, and saying that they're standing against that. And so That's the best I can do for at least in right now. Let's say that I am learning and I am reading about this and working on it. But right now, that's the best I can do as far as justification goes from a Christian perspective. I think then once you go to some of the passages that we even cited in the question about the render unto Caesar what Caesar's, or honor the emperor, or submit to governing authorities, those would, it seems to me, be much more clear as far as the Christian response in that kind of situation. So I guess I would say, yeah, I think that the call to honor and submit is a call that is more clear and I think more biblically compelling than just natural law and the sovereignty of the individual. And some of those things do have some kind of Christian roots, but
influence. Yeah.
Yeah. Not the clear statement of scripture like you have these other places.
Right. And I think the taxation piece is a great one to ask about, because we've already talked about Jesus being asked, should we pay taxes to Caesar and render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's? And you didn't have representation with Caesar. There was a Roman Senate, and especially where they were given a governor, and here you go, here's your governor of the Roman government. You don't send your representatives to appeal to Caesar. You don't have people that sit in the Senate or the Congress or some parliament or anything like that. That's not the setup that they had. So we live with benefits and easier systems than they ever had. And it's just interesting that I don't like taxes. No one likes taxes. But that's, I think, to a large degree why there was a revolution in the first place. And that, and that has me thinking about, reminds me of two things. So friends, if you're listening, you want to know why did they do that? Why did they declare independence? I would highly recommend reading the Declaration of Independence. They state why they are declaring independence. And I could go through it, but there's, I don't know, 20 reasons they list. They don't have bullet points, but it's listed out line by line. The king did this, and he did this, and he shouldn't have done this, and he did this, and even though we appealed, he did it again and again and again. So they have reasons why they did it, and a lot of it is taxes, and a lot of it is we put this legislature and he dissolved it, and we wanted to make some of our own decisions, and he wanted to make those decisions. So, like you said, I'm more compelled. I find the biblical argument to be more compelling that it's not a just revolution. And that's not to say we're not thankful for the results of the revolution. I'm grateful. I'm glad to have the system we have and the assumptions that are there, and that I can be treated as an individual. There's good things there. But the starting place, I don't know. I want to look at it with humility and not just assume everything's golden and lovely because we happen to benefit from it. And then one other thing, especially if the asker of the question or anyone else thinking, how do I teach my kids? I just finished Thomas S. Kidd's 2 volumes, American History. And it's kind of a quick, high level. But he goes through all this. Here are the factors that led into the revolution. Here's the different acts that happened. And it's a nice high level, so it's a little bit more breezy. And I would definitely recommend that if you're trying to get your head on right about what is our history, so I can teach it well. And I like that he brought in a lot of stories of people that may not make a normal history book. Like here were some of the people on the ground, or the regular, or maybe some views from an oppressed person here, or a peasant person here, or that kind of thing. And he brought those in to give a good flavor to the history. So. Big recommendation there.
Well, one of the one of the applications, even that the person asked the question made, was this seems quite relevant in our time. And some of the reason it seems so relevant is there are a lot of things that we're not liking right now. We're in, hopefully, well, for you, you're in the middle of a pandemic because you've got it, but maybe we're at the end of all of the regulations or nearing the end, we hope. But nonetheless, it's been a really disruptive and unpleasant year and a half while we've been under various governmental mandates to wear masks and have distance and all these other things that we've had. And people have cited the need to rebel or the need to assert their rights or the need to do, you know, in some respect, what the founders did when they were revolting against Britain here. And I think that's some of the question we have to come to. I mean, what is really clear here is how does the Christian then engage these other issues, or even more clearly, how does a Christian engage government overreach? Because you can have whatever opinion you want about government overreach and what is and what isn't that, but is it patently Christian to dissent and to revolt when you have government overreach? Is that the criteria for a revolution? And that's why this is relevant, it seems to me. And so you've got that kind of question now that was really the question there. And is the government overreach now, is it less onerous than the taxation was? I mean, who's to say? Who's to say I'm the judge and this is bad enough to revolt? But I do think you still have the clear statements of scripture about the honoring the emperor and the governor and submitting to authorities as instituted by God. Those things are still there and they're clear. But anyway, I think the question is worth asking simply for contemporary relevance. So thank you for asking it. Let me say it.
Yeah. Yeah. So is there a point at which something, an authority becomes so unjust, so wicked, that we don't need to submit to it? And we're talking about overreach, but overreach is in the eye of the beholder, right?
Well, I think that's really important. That's a really important distinction. Yes, overreach is in the eye of the beholder. Wickedness is not. Mm-hmm. Wickedness is different, seems to me. I mean, taxes are not inherently wicked. Mm-hmm. So one of the suggestions you made was about the midwives in the Egyptian edict to kill all the children. That is a wicked edict. Killing children I don't know who would say, yes, killing children is, you know, that's negotiable. It's not a negotiable thing. It's evil. And so should you obey that? The Hebrew midwives didn't. And of course, God bless them for it. But that to me is an important question. Is there a distinction between government mandating wickedness and overreach? Mm-hmm. It seems to me there is.
Yeah, I'm not forced. I could be, I suppose, coerced, but I am not required to sin in my submission. And one of the things I was thinking about is that a little bit of dissent, or I'm not gonna follow this particular edict because it's evil, does not mean I now can whole cloth ignore the whole government. Because I think sometimes there's that assumption. Okay, you struck out once. Now I don't have to listen to you at all because you've proved faulty. But I think that you can do that at an action level. is this a just thing? No, it's not a just thing. I can't do this thing. I can't do this evil thing.
Well, another biblical example of pushing back on a government mandate was Daniel, when he was asked to mandated to eat the king's food, and he found a way to speak against that and to not eat the king's food without overthrowing the government. He was a loyal servant of that government while he, you know, might say dissented and honored God. He honored God and remained in service of that wicked government. And that was a matter of conscience for him. It wasn't a matter of wickedness. It was a little bit different. But that seems to me to be a reasonable approach to that. Again, not what they did in the revolution, but a reasonable approach. So. Mm-hmm.
I think one more for Daniel, which I just think is super interesting. There's an edict. The other big Daniel story we all know, Daniel in the lion's den. There's an edict. You can't pray. You can only pray to the king. You can't pray to any other gods. Daniel said, "Okay, I'm not gonna do that. I'm gonna pray to God. I'm gonna pray to Yahweh." So he did not do as the edict asked. But then there was no. I'm surprised by how honorable he was in the consequence of his actions. All right, you're going to the lion's den now. Okay, this is what we do. Like, I would think, okay, I'm not going to pray the way you want me to pray, and I'm going to bail, and I'm going to run, and I'm going to do whatever I'm going to do. You've proved illegitimate now. But his example is just different than that. And... at very least, we can take that as an example. I'm not exactly sure how that applies in every situation modern, but it seems like a more humble position than my base assumption.
Well, the funny thing is, it was not Daniel who said, "This is a stupid law." It was the king who then realized, "Oh, I've made a stupid law," which I think is kind of funny. But it's different than some kind of revolutionary approach to the government based on a stupid law.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I don't know really how many other things we need to go to from the scripture to talk about how does the scripture point us in this direction? But I will say one other thing about Daniel. Daniel lived as an exile. We've talked here just recently even about the church having an identity as exiles. And that governed really how he approached the king. Mm-hmm. And I think his examples were good examples. So
I agree. She did ask for instances in the New Testament, which I think is a good question. And we have more in the Old Testament, and I'm even thinking of just the prophets talking against full nations and full states, in Amos or the Book of the Twelve. There's a lot of that going on in the Old Testament. I'm harder pressed to see that kind of thing in the New Testament. Obviously, Herod gave a similar edict to people in his jurisdiction that the midwives were given in Exodus. So that same dissent could have applied there. And the only other thing I could think of was and we talked about this in a prior podcast, but that smaller jurisdiction, not a full governing authority, but a smaller jurisdiction telling the apostles that you can't preach the gospel. And they said, "We can't do that. We're going to preach the gospel." That's a smaller institution. That's a smaller authority. But I think that's a similar posture in regards to bad edicts.
Yeah, I think the only other thing that comes to mind is just how radically the governing authorities are represented in Revelation. But even there isn't a rebellion or a revolution led by the followers of Jesus. At the end, Jesus himself leads it, but that's, we'll go for that. But before that, there's not, even though they're beasts and they're dragons and they're represented in wicked, wicked terms, there's not, there's just suffering represented by God's people. There's not standing up for your rights and that sort of thing. But that's, maybe that's a different topic.
I'm sure there's more episodes just flowing out of this. That final question, was Britain worse than Nero? I'm hard pressed to say that Britain was worse than Nero. And one of the things I found really interesting when I was finishing up that kit, or when I was reading the revolutionary part of the kid book, is he was talking about the French and Indian War, which, if you know your history a little bit, is where George Washington got his start. And the French and the French and the British were fighting, and some were using different Native American tribes to join in that fight. So England spent a lot of money defending the colonies, and in trying to figure out how do we recoup all of this money that we use in defending these colonies, that's where you get a lot of the taxes we've already referred to. They were trying to fill up the coffers because they got spent in the New World, spending a lot of money in the French and Indian War. So it's just circumstances. A lot of it's just, here's what happened. Here's the history, events. It's just fascinating, especially if you get all those factors in there. So again, would recommend doing some reading.
And so, I mean, one of the things that's interesting, and I think what we probably ought to note this, you mentioned, we've come out and said, we don't really see it. From a biblical Christian perspective, yes, let's have a revolution. Yet, we both have benefited from that. And I think our question asker has as well. And I think it's turned out good. I think there's been good things come of it. And I'm just going to say, God does it all the time. He does it all the time, where he raises up kings and deposes princes, and things happen quickly, or they happen for bad reasons, and God brings good from it. And that's one of the reasons that we prefer the kingdom of heaven over the kingdoms of men, because we have a God who does that kind of thing in the course of human events. So I'm hopeful because of that.
Yeah. And I like that I'm not required to take a stance that's all in. It doesn't have to be all in, and I don't have to completely defend everything about the country in which I live. I can be grateful for it, and I can, especially as a student of history, I can have a very nuanced view about the revolution. And the question asker is asking, how do we do this? How do I teach my kids? And I'd say dig in and learn the history, because it's not going to be one simple answer. There's going to be a lot of factors, a lot of things were in play, and just describe that whole thing. And it doesn't have to be, was it a Christian revolution? No, get that off the table. You can describe why the revolution occurred, and you can describe why we benefit from it, and it's a good setup. It's a good system. We came out ahead. Things are going well. But it doesn't have to be this very simple. It's not a binary thing. It's not either this or this. There's so much nuance and so many factors in play in the revolution, and I would encourage those type of answers. Those are the type of answers we need.
Yeah, thank you for that. The non-binary is really important. And we don't live in a non-binary world. Everybody wants it to be us against them. And so I think that that's really good counsel, Eric. There's, I always think about, I get home and I ask, get the question, did you have a good day? Well, I had a good, bad day, basically. There are good things about the day and there are bad things about the day. And it's always a good, bad day. There's always something that is good and something bad. Nothing is completely good. Very few things are completely bad. And I think the revolution is probably one of those things also that is mixed in that regard. there was kind of a final question that talked about what do the Puritans think about it? And we mentioned that already a little bit, but I think it's worth noting that the Puritan heritage of dissent was part of the what I think led to the revolution. And I would note that we still have that now. That's really what is going on with a lot of the people who are uptight about governmental mandates now. It's not that they have great biblical reasons. It's that they have a history of dissent that they may not even recognize comes all the way down through there that is parallel or adjacent to Christianity and biblical reasons, but isn't necessarily Christian or biblical. And so I think there's that. I think the fact that they were so recently oppressed and, you know, within two or three generations and came to this world to get away from that and then felt it again, they naturally were going to dissent or rebel there as well. And so I think a lot of it had to do with the atmosphere that they had and the cultural, well, like we have cultural Christianity, their cultural Christianity was different than ours, but nonetheless had some aspects that were extra biblical, extra Christian as well. And those are the, I would say, the Puritan factors that went toward the revolution. I don't know that you could say that the Great Awakening had much effect on the revolution, except that perhaps it re-emphasized the value of the individual and the response of the individual essentially in faith to the Lord. So there was that, and how much then that translated to an individual conscience, an individual freedom of conscience that led to a revolution. It's hard to say that, but that could have been a factor. So that's kind of as good as I can do, I think, on the Puritans' view of the revolution.
And I already mentioned the sermon, quoting that one, which was a pro-revolution sermon, obviously. And there were plenty of, if we just go broad, Christian, not just Puritans, there were plenty of Christians that were loyalists as well. And any talk about Puritans being dissenters could probably be paralleled with members of the Anglican Church or the Church of England. If I'm a member of the Church of England and not a more dissonant group, I'm more likely to be on the loyalist side. So there were differing Christian responses in all of this. And I think we were talking one time about a lot of the loyalists ended up going towards what would become Canada. And so you have a lot of their history is of loyalist history, and they left a place that was generally being disloyal.
And some of it, you know, there aren't too many loyalist sermons around. Some of that was, I think, destroyed so that it would appear more unified than it was, too.
That makes it a lot easier when you're trying to get a declaration signed and figured out. So,
yeah, it was a hard time to be alive. I mean, it's a hard time to be alive now. There you go. That's kind of how it rolls.
Well, I think that was a great question. I think it's helpful. And go teach your kids. Do well. Disciple them well while you're in exile. We talked about that already in a prior episode. So I greatly encourage people trying to do this thing well so that their kids learn the good, the beautiful, and the true. Learn it organized properly with the right amount of nuance that they can handle and all those things. So they are good exiles waiting for the kingdom. So I want to remind everyone, don't forget to subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts and rate us. If you find what we're doing helpful, a review would go a long way to getting this to other people. Share it with a friend. Put it on the socials. Do what you do in that regard. If you have questions, send them to podcast@newlifenw.com. And we look forward to the next conversation. Awesome.